Hello, everybody, our listeners. This is a special edition of Hela Ya Hela show. Here we have a collective work going on between Hela Ya Hela, Crossroads, and Joseph Palestinian News between Monday from 11:30 to 12. So basically, we have here four people in the studio. We're going to be talking to Labib Habib, who's a human rights lawyer, came from Israel and Palestine a couple of days ago. He's here, been brought by Alternatives to participate in a conference against racism. And again, I say he's a human rights lawyer working and living in Israel. He's a legal advisor for a committee against torture in Israel. So we're going to just let him introduce himself and talk to us a little bit about what he does. Hi.
Okay, hi. My name is Labib Habib. I'm a Palestinian and Israeli citizen. I was born in Nazareth, the Arab biggest city in Israel. I belong to a Palestinian minority which have an Israeli citizenship. It counts about a million, more than a million Palestinians living in Israel. I'm a lawyer. I work in the human rights field with the Palestinian detainees against also house demolitions and etc. I now stay and work in Jerusalem, working and going to the military courts, Israeli military courts in Ramallah and in all the occupied territories.
Yes, you have something to say, sir.
This is Joseph Al-Malih, by the way, from the Jukwa Palestinian. Could you you represent Palestinian detainees and inmates in Israeli courts and jails, in addition to cases of torture and home demolitions. Could you give us some example of these cases you worked on?
In the field of torture, I am a legal advisor for the committee, the public committee against torture in Israel, which also fights to monitor and fight torturing Palestinian detainees. We have some cases. One of it is a case from 95, in which one Palestinian was detained, tortured until he lost his mind. We are suing now the State of Israel and GSS, which is the General Security Intelligence, for torturing this Palestinian and as I said, causing him to lose his mind totally.
How long has the case been going on for?
We had filed this case, this suit, 1 year ago, and we are waiting to the first hearing.
So it's a pretty young case. I hear about cases that really take years and decades even to go through. Can you tell us about the success rate of these cases that take a long time, and if you can give us an example of one case that's been going on for a number of years?
Of course. Today we have a big problem of legal services, having the Palestinian having legal services because of the siege and the closure which is imposed upon the whole Palestinian people. It's very difficult for Palestinians to contact lawyer or to contact the Israeli courts.
When can they contact a lawyer?
I just want to emphasize that is the Palestinian courts cannot deal with or cannot sue Palestinian can't sue an Israeli, the Israeli state or an Israeli GSS or official in a Palestinian court. He needs to go to an Israeli court. And reaching the Israeli court is very difficult today. First, as I explained, because of the closures and all the war and all the siege which is imposed upon the Palestinians. Second, the Israeli court demand paying from Palestinians, because they are not citizens, to pay a big sum fees, a big fees of money, and this is another problem to a Palestinian to reach the court. Because of this, we have some cases which is going years and years, and just because of this problem, fees problem.
Mr. Habib, you represent cases of Palestinian Arabs in Israel, or also from the occupied territories?
In general, I represent Palestinians from the occupied territories. My work is in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is the is part of East Jerusalem is part of the occupied territories. So my work is in general with Palestinians from the occupied territories, especially in this time of war and human rights problems and all the war crimes which is committed against Palestinians. The most important thing now is to help and to in order to try and to help Palestinians dealing with these problems.
You, as a lawyer, you work like you have your own office, or do you work with a group of lawyers? And how many cases do you handle right now, if I may ask?
As a Palestinian lawyer, representing Palestinian detainees, we have as a bunch of lawyers, a group of lawyers. We have
We collaborate together. I'm going to be translating when it's hard for him because his first language is Hebrew and Arabic.
Arabic, yes. Of
and
course.
And then Hebrew.
Yeah. We are trying to collaborate in order to easy and make it easy for us, the lawyers, to make our work. You have to understand that going to the military court means to cross checkpoints and go through many checkpoints. Palestinian lawyers are Palestinians, in fact, and as well as Palestinians cannot move in a siege or in a situation of curfew, and or in also Palestinian lawyers cannot reach the court, the military court. And there is a problem of representing such detainees, because even the lawyer, the Palestinian lawyer, cannot reach the military court, or cannot get out of his house, his village, his city, because he is a part of his people. He is a part of the problem.
Yes. We're going to go to a track now from Bethlehem. A family are talking about the living under the occupation. So we're going to go to that track, and then we're going to come back for more questions. Thank you.
exactly is occupation? The typical American doesn't understand what the difference is between the West Bank and Israel.
Occupation, when somebody stronger than you comes in with his war machine and sits on your land, just stays on your land and changes your lifestyle.
What are some examples of the way Israelis do that?
Well, for instance, take it now. The area of Bethlehem is closed. Bethlehemites cannot go out. You know, if you want to go to Jerusalem, even to the old city, which supposedly an occupied city, you cannot go. A Christian cannot go on Sunday to the Holy Sepulchre to pray. A Muslim cannot go on Friday to the Dome of the Rock to pray, unless he has a permit. And on another angle, if somebody is ill and he needs medical treatment, on the checkpoint, even if he's old, like 65, 70, even if he's a woman, if he does not have a permit to enter, they call it now Israel, but it's not Israel, to go to the hospital for treatment, they will not allow him.
And this audio is from Bethlehem. You can find it at www.freespeech.org. That's freespeech.org. Here in the studio at CKUT, we're talking to Labib Habib, a human rights lawyer, a Palestinian human rights lawyer living and working in Israel. Sama has a question here, if you can direct it.
Marhaba, Labib. My question concerns the child political prisoners. We have received reports. As of February 16 of this year, there are between 155 and 160 Palestinian child political prisoners detained in several Israeli facilities. Approximately 50 are in the Talmud prison, 15 to 20 in Ofek Juvenile Detention Center, and those children, some of them are as young as 14. Approximately 70 aged 16 and 17 are detained in the Megiddo military prison, one girl aged 15 in Ramallah women's prison, one girl detained in Moscovia compound in Jerusalem, 15 other children detained in various detention centers in the West Bank, including Adoraim, Hebron area, and Etzion, Bethlehem area. And as in previous months, children continue to be detained, denied access to family visits, and in some cases to lawyers. I'd like you to comment on this.
In general, I would say that the first victims of this occupation policy and war policy, I would say, are children. Children are being killed, are being imprisoned, are being detained all the time. I would say that children also get through a very hard investigation. They are prohibited to see a lawyer in general, and most of the time to see a lawyer until they made to confess, or until they confess of what of the suspect the suspects against them. So a boy, a child can be detained for 10 or 15 days or 20 without seeing a lawyer, and after he would be charged and sentenced for a long time, which could come to many years, there is a problem to see his family because of the closure. Families can't get into Israel, and you have to remember and to know that Palestinian detainees are imprisoned in Israel, not in the occupied territories, but in prisons in Israel, so that a Palestinian child can't see his family because his family can't go into Israel, even can't go out of her village. There is of course, an apartheid in sentencing Palestinians. You have to know that in the occupied territories we have also 200,000 settlers living in the occupied territories, occupied Palestinian territories. But on the one hand, Palestinians are sentenced in a military courts, and on the other hand, settlers who does the same things that Palestinians do are sentenced and charged in a civil Israeli court inside Israel. I would give you one example of this.
There's that case where the settler, was it in 97, is it, in Khalil, where the settler was given a 6 months community work for killing a Palestinian child?
Yes.
Is this the case?
Yes, it was Nahum Korman, a settler who is responsible for the security of the settlement, who killed a Palestinian child. The Israeli court...
How did he kill the child?
With his... stamped on his neck. Stamping on his neck. He was charged and the Israeli court found him guilty of manslaughter, second degree, or manslaughter of this child, because you can understand that for Israelis or for the court, a Jew does not intend to kill an Arab. It can't happen. And he was, as I said, convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 6 months community service. On the other hand, a 20-year-old Abir Omar, a Palestinian, was lightly stabbed, an Israeli soldier, lightly stabbed, and was sentenced to 20 years in the Ramallah military court. So we can see and understand the discrimination we are talking about.
Well, obviously it is a discrimination. But I would like to ask you about maybe part of the discrimination also. There's some Israelis claim that Palestinian women send their children to face the...
To be in the front line?
Right? To be in the front line, and that they are sacrificing and they don't care about their children. And as a lawyer, as a Palestinian, and as a specialist in human rights, I would like you to give us more details about
it. Yes, of course. I would say that if Palestinian children was or were sitting in their homes playing internet or playing piano or I don't know, and the mother calls them or one calls them to go out and to throw children, it would be right what you are what they are saying. But you have to understand that Palestinian children face occupation in daily and every day by crossing and facing soldiers in the way to schools, coming back from schools, because Israeli checkpoints and Israeli soldiers are everywhere, every day. You have to understand also that the Palestinian child see with his eyes all the humiliation which his father or his family go through. He sees his house being demolished by Israelis. And a child, I would say that the Palestinian child will come a man and will come responsible of feeding his family or helping in feeding his family and go to and going to work because of the poverty and because of the bad situation and because of his father was killed, and he has to help, and he has to take his father's place. So it is this sentence is more similar to a famous sentence, which, as I remember, was said by Queen Elizabeth when they told her that the people are starving, there's no bread.
It's the French Revolution.
Sorry. And she said, so let them eat cakes and cookies.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
It's taken out of context. Our next track here, also from Bethlehem, and he's talking about humiliation under the occupation. So we're going to listen to that, and then we're going to come back to some more questions. Thank you.
There's nothing positive about occupation. Occupation is an occupation. It's always done by military force, not by love and harmony. The Israeli occupation made drastic change in the life of the individuals. It restricted their movement. It made them feel extremely unsafe. It exposed them to a lot of humiliation. Before the uprising, there were a lot of humiliating measures imposed by the so-called Israeli civil administration. Actually, all of the employees of that Israeli civil administration are military people, but they changed military with the word civil, only to make it look nice, but it is military. And even if you want to, if you apply for, the Israeli occupation here controlled everything, water, electricity, telephone. If you apply for a telephone line, can you imagine you wait, some people waited for 15 years to get a telephone line. They use these things to abuse the individuals to become collaborators with them. For instance, the reunion of families. Some Palestinians were out during 1967 and they were not counted in the statistics. So they were not considered as West Bank residents. And when they used to come here, they were allowed to come here only on visiting permits for 1 month, renewable 1 month, but they have to leave. Imagine you are, your home is here, the rest of your family is here, but you cannot live here. This is very important for the outside world to know. And when you apply for a reunion to come and join your family, your wife and your kids, you go through all of these bargaining. If you, okay, you collaborate with us, we'll give you this, we'll do that for you. But this is humiliating. Can you imagine if somebody comes and asks you to betray your country, how humiliating it is? To get a telephone line or to become reunited with your family? Not to forget the humiliating measures they used to do on the crossing points, on the border points between here and Jordan. You know, you have to go into a small room, you have to strip, to search you naked. This was one of the things. They go through all of your things, all of your bags, and they confiscate things without telling you. And when you go out of the crossing point and you find it out, you cannot claim it. You cannot go to them and say, oh, you guys, I lost this and lost that. It's very evil, very vicious. Occupation is very evil, very vicious.
This is a special edition of Hela Yehela for Off the Hour on CKUT, which is happening every Monday and Fridays between 5 and 6 here. In the studio, we have a human rights lawyer, a Palestinian human rights lawyer, from Israel, Labib Habib, and we're a bunch of people here bombarding him with questions. Other than me and Hala, there's Sama from Caravan, which is every Wednesday from 2 to 3. And there's Joseph, who is for the Palestinian radio program here, also on CKUT every Monday from 11:30 to 12. This audio, you can find it at www.freespeech.org, a family from Bethlehem again. I have another question for Labib, and the question goes as follows. Palestinians living in Palestine or living in Israel, there's a million Palestinians living in Israel itself, don't learn their history, learn very little. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? What do you learn at school as a Palestinian?
First of all, I would like to say that, to explain that in 1948, when the state of Israel was established, there were 1 million Palestinians living in Israel, and two-thirds of them became refugees out of their country after they were expelled and got out of their country. Now we have 1 million Palestinians, more than 1 million Palestinians living in Israel and are Israeli citizens. I would say that my feeling as a Palestinian in Israel is like a stranger in his own land. I would say that Israel tried throughout these years to change and to erase every Palestinian mark, like names of cities, names of villages, as 50 Palestinian villages were destroyed in the 1948 war.
Were they all renamed?
Most of them were renamed with the Israeli or Jewish names. The Arabic language, although according to the law it's an official language, it's not used. I studied my studied law in Hebrew. I must confess that my Hebrew is better than my Arabic, especially when I represent at court. And it was for me, as an example, when I were a child and got out of Israel to Egypt, to visit Egypt, I was very surprised and felt very enjoyed not seeing the pyramids or the big city, but seeing Cairo with Arabic signs and just Arabic signs. It was very exciting for me, and I felt that I belong there. So I would say that feeling a stranger in your own land is very difficult. And I will say also that Israel is confiscating and has confiscated lands from Palestinians living in Israel. Palestinians had owned as 93 of the land of Israel, Israel in Israel, and now they own just 3% of the land. Nazareth, as an example, is a very poor city, besieged with Jewish settlements, and as a young person, I have nowhere to build. I have no land to build my house, and if I want to go and to live the city life, to go to coffee shops or to go to the university, I would have to be an Israeli. I would have to forget my Palestinian identity. And I would say that even you forget your Palestinian identity and say that you are an Israeli, you won't be accepted, because Israel defines itself as the Jewish state. The central law in Israel, which characterizes the country and is unique to it, is the law of return. Under the law of return, every Jew could come to Israel and automatically become a citizen, while its own indigenous Palestinian people can't and don't have a place to live in, a place to develop. Israel didn't build any city or Palestinian village from 48 till now, although it succeeded to build many Jewish villages and settlements in Israel. So I would say that the feeling is that you are not murahab. You are not welcomed in your own land.
Okay, I was wondering that. I have a question, because you are somebody who within this situation who are literally caught in the middle, because you are Palestinian of origin and yet you have an Israeli citizenship. So I'm wondering what two questions. What makes you different from a Palestinian who is living outside of Israel and who doesn't have an Israeli citizenship? And what makes you different from a non-Arab Israeli living in Israel? What are the rights that you have, the pros and the cons, the good and the bad, being a Palestinian who has an Israeli citizenship?
I would say that Israel see, especially in this time, see and see its Palestinian citizens as a demographic danger. Sometimes Israel would think and would it is convinced that the million Palestinians living in Israel are the most dangerous threat. I would say that on the other hand, I would say that as a citizen, I have some rights more than a Palestinian living in the occupied territories.
What are they, those rights? Can you give us basic examples?
Okay, I can go to universities, Israeli universities. I can move in Israel almost free.
We have
medical coverage. But on the other hand, we have 100,000 Palestinians who are citizens, who live in villages which is called unrecognized villages. It is villages who existed before 48, before the establishment of Israel, and yet Israeli state didn't or hasn't recognized these villages till now. So on the maps you cannot see these villages. People there live without water, without telephone lines, without electricity or health facilities. In the 90s, Israel became or started to recognize a few of them and to slowly connect them.
Was that after the Oslo Accord?
Yes. But it's not enough, and the majority of these 100,000 Palestinians are still living in a third world conditions.
Are these different from the people who are living in caves? Because I was really surprised last weekend to find out that there are actually people who've moved into caves to live in. Can you just a little bit clarify that, what's going on?
There are some people in the occupied territories who live in caves. As far as I know, Israel is trying to
get them out, move them?
Yes, move them.
Why? Why does it create a problem for Israel?
Because Israel wants to confiscate and to use these lands for building
settlements.
We have also to remember that there are refugees in Israel. The establishment of the state caused for uprooting of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their villages, and 45,000 of them remained inside the new state, but were uprooted and transferred to another villages. It's called the uprooted villages. Till now, and although the Supreme Court recognized the right of some residents of three such villages to return to their villages, the government prevented implement these decisions by declaring the land as a closed military area.
With that, we're going to go to our next audio from Bethlehem. And the family are talking about taxation within the occupied territories. We're going to go to that. Thank you all.
Israel, they, during the occupation, they controlled the taxation. But taxation were not imposed fairly. There were no rules and regulations on percentages. Also, let's go back to the simple rule. According, I think, to Geneva Convention, an occupation force cannot collect taxes from their occupants, from the country they are occupying. It's against international conventions. So, but they were collecting this in a very, without scales. I know in the U.S. they have scales and on your income, percentages and so on, and ranges and so on. But here, no. Just they decide, you have to pay this, and that's it. If you don't pay, they come and take your factory, they come and take your machines. They took the furniture of the houses. They launched a campaign on our town, Beit Sahur, a few years ago, and they confiscated over $5 million worth of furniture, equipments, and supplies and things, even small cookers in the house. They took it away. They sweeped some of the houses, they sweeped it.
Hello everybody again, this is Hela Yehela for Off the Hour, which is every Monday and Friday from 5 to 6. Here in our studio we have Labib Habib, a human rights lawyer, a Palestinian human rights lawyer who's come from Israel to talk to us about the occupied territories and people's rights and racism. In the studio here we have Sama from Caravan, which is every Wednesday from 2 to 3, and we have Joseph, who's for the Palestinian radio program every Monday at 11:30 to noon, and we go to our next question.
Labib, in your work, do you cooperate with the Israeli human rights groups?
Yes, of course. As I said, I am a legal advisor for an Israeli NGO.
Which one?
A public committee against torture, which succeeded 2 years ago, 3 years ago, in 1999, to have a Supreme Court, Israeli Supreme Court decision prohibiting torture in Israel. There are some Israeli NGOs who works in this field, trying to help help Palestinians and to face the Israeli breaches of the humanitarian law. Although I think it's not enough. I think there is a problem in the left wing, the Israeli left wing, which is paralyzed today, and which is muted, and we don't hear enough of him. But I think there is some hope to change this situation.
Do you get any funds from UNRWA, the United Nations, for relief of the refugees? They have schools, they have hospitals in the occupied territories. Can you get funds for legal counseling?
There are funds for NGOs and for bodies who works and helps Palestinians. I don't have statistics and I don't have numbers, but I know that it's not sufficient if you compare it with the war or the war crimes which is done today in the Palestinian territories.
It is unfortunate that as Palestinians you feel like a stranger in your home, but is there a future? What is going to happen to the Palestinian Arabs inside Israel? You think it's possible or one day we're going to have peace and we're going to put this all behind?
I think the Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel are fighting and demanding that Israel would be the state of all its citizens. This is our first demand. Palestinians in the occupied territories demands to stop and to end the occupation. I think that the our main struggle as Palestinians and also Israelis together is to end occupation and end racism, because I think racism and discrimination damages and the two people. I would like to quote a Jewish Israeli writer, Bet Michael, his name, from an Israeli newspaper. He wrote it on March 15 this year. He said, and I will free translate it, there is no doubt that the road or the way, the historical way that the Jewish people had got through in the last 60 years, from 48 to this year, can be a very good background or information in order to make historical research. He said that in the last 60 years, the Jewish people had become from a people who was numbered and tagged to a people who is numbering and tagging another people. From a humiliated people and discriminated to a people who is humiliating and discriminating others. From a people who was a victim of a transfer and racist policy to a people who is very enthusiastic about transfer policy. This writer says that the microbe of racism, there's no people who have immunity or immunization from this microbe, and in this way all people are equal. Every people can be could become racist, and it's our common bond. It's our common struggle as all people, as Arabs, Palestinians, Jews, Israelis, and I think it's the world struggle, is to fight racism and to make it maybe a better world for all of us.
Speaking of making it a better world for all of us, this is a collective work here at CKUT. I would really thank Labib Habib for being with us here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I would like to thank Joseph from the Palestinian radio show every Monday from 11:30 to 12. And of course, Sama, last but not least, from Caravan every Wednesday from 2 to 3. Before we go to music, and then we come back for Hela, the second Hela, by the way. There's two Helas here. So we go back to the second Hela and talk about Concordia's vigil in Miguel.
You want to stop the violence, first and foremost, okay? You come in, you have children, you have Zinni coming in and trying to say ceasefire. All of a sudden, you come in Jerusalem today, some guy blows himself up. I'm not happy either. I don't think it's great.
We're not happy to have
it. I understand.
Why are we doing it? Why these people are suffering? You know why? Because there is something called justice. There's something called humanity.
Okay.
These people are missing. They don't know it.
Okay, but hold on a second. Israel and the occupied territories, let's split them up.
You know what?
No, it's not a question. In Israel? In Israel, you're right.
You have a million Israeli Arabs in Israel. A million.
Because Israel, you know what? Israel has conceded. They come in and they said, listen, we're going to give you the territories. We're going to try to figure out a way, all right? We have a lot of obstacles, namely Jerusalem, which is a big, big obstacle in the whole peace process, all right? Refugees is also a big problem. What I don't understand is, like, you've got, you know, 10 Arab states, 10 Arab very rich countries around who don't... I don't understand. You know what? As Arabs, which, you know what? If there were Jews in America who helped, they help. They come, you know, whether it's with, you know, monetarily... Hold on a second. Monetarily or politically, they help. Why is it that, why is it that, you know, Jordanians have refugee camps and Lebanon and Lebanese have refugee camps for Palestinians? What, they're not part of them? You know, instead of trying to help them out? I don't understand. They say it's your problem. Keep them there.
I have also a question.
Maybe, can I throw an idea
Absolutely,
here?
Absolutely, go ahead.
They accept them and integrate them with their population, and definitely the Palestinians will never be able to go back to their homeland. Did you ever think about that? That if they become Palestinians, become Lebanese, become Jordanians, and that's it.
But you know what? I mean, in the course of history, people move. People move around the world. And I'm not going to say that it's justified. Sometimes it's not justified. Look at all the 6 million Jews that died and all the millions of Jews that have to leave their homes and never even had to look back, you know? You move and you build your lives elsewhere. I'm not saying that that's the right position, but you know what? Sometimes for the better of your people, you do it. The same way Jews did it, other people do it. Okay, you know what? Bottom line is occupied territories.
I've had 5,000 years ago.
You were kicked out 2,000 years ago.
50 years ago, I
don't have to go 2,000 years ago. If you want me to justify myself 2,000 years ago, you're going to lose.
Okay, and that was a slice of life from what was going on in the hallways of Concordia University yesterday. Starting March 20th, the SPHR, which is the Palestinian Human Rights Club at Concordia, has been holding a happening for the past 3 days, from the 20th to the 22nd, which is today, and it was called Concordia Under Occupation. So it has been brought back here. And what they were basically doing was setting up, recreating the atmosphere of a city that was under occupation. So you'd walk in. On the first day, they had people dressed as soldiers who were patrolling the area in the airport of the Hall Building of Concordia, and they were recreating the atmosphere of checkpoints and IDing people and stuff like that, very randomly, so that if you'd have to walk out of the building, somebody would stop you, and he'd be in military gear and be like, "Show me your ID. Where are you from? What are you doing here?" And upstairs in the mezzanine, what they had going on was a vigil for the child martyrs who have passed away, hundreds of them, over the past, how long has it been, 17 months of the Intifada. And it was shocking to a lot of people, but it was also very saddening because they had some mock graves set up, and they were very beautifully done. They had little pebbles there as the graves and the gravestones and the tombstones, and they had flowers laid down and photographs of a lot of the martyrs. And these are not people who are suicide bombers, but rather children who were caught in the crossfire, as we say. So also, I have a little interview that I did with two people who seemed to be quite fired up about this whole situation, and I asked them about how they were feeling. And this is what one of them has to say.
This is retarded. Like, I'm not pro-Jew, I'm not pro-Muslim, I'm not pro-anything. I'm Canadian, I'm a Christian Catholic, and that coming to school, even if it was the Judaism, and they had a whole thing on Jews and the Israeli and how they're mistreated, I'd still be very upset. I don't think it.
Can you tell me?
I beg your pardon? Sorry?
How does it stand in the way of your everyday? When you come here to school, how does this stand in your way?
What is it inside you that's bothering you so much? Think for yourself. And to answer me honestly, why are you so personally offended by
Truth it? And honestly, I'm offended. I'm not offended by this. I just don't think it's proper to have this in school. If they want to educate...
What's not proper about it?
I don't...
That's racist?
No, that's very shocking, and it's very provocative. It's very provocative, and there are some pictures there that are very provocative. Like, I saw the whole thing, I took the whole tour, and there are some pictures that are very provocative and shocking. And it's appalling that they have to have this in my school. I don't want to go to school and have this.
Where is the proper place for this?
I don't know.
Is there a proper place?
I mean, if they want to... What's the point of this? What is the point of this?
What is the point of remembering any crimes against humanity at all, so that it doesn't happen again, so that you increase awareness, so that you show people what has been done wrong? And I can understand why people might get upset, but they're not pointing fingers. This is a vigil in the name of the children who died.
That's the one thing I really, really like is that
I think they are pointing fingers.
They're not.
I think they are pointing fingers because if you could see, I'm Leslie Wasserman, I'm a
Okay, so to continue what he was saying, they are pointing fingers, because I hadn't realized at that point that although it was very solemn, it was very beautiful in its sadness, there were actually these huge signs in the back of everything, of the presentation itself, that said "Made in Israel," which personally I thought was, I mean, for me, I was somebody who was caught in the middle ground, because I understood the Jewish students, and by the way, this clip is in no way a representation of the overall reaction of students at Concordia. It just happens to be that they were close to me and I had my recorder on me and they looked very upset. So basically, for me, as someone who's caught in the middle, I thought it's something necessary, and you have to be controversial in times like these in order to inspire dialogue, because in the end, we were talking to these two people and they sort of tried, they understood the other side in the end of it. Exactly. But it was a bit much to have a sign that said "Made in Israel," because I think that's already obvious. And if you're trying to commemorate the tragic deaths of these children, you don't need to go that far. But overall, it was quite effective. Sama, you had something to say?
Well, actually, Hala, you were lucky that you were allowed in and allowed to make those interviews.
I'm always undercover.
Concordia wouldn't allow journalists to go freely and to interview people, and this was reported yesterday in La Presse.
Oh, I see.
So,
and
that's very worrisome, that a university should shut a public place to
Definitely.
The media because they didn't want them to see what's going on.
It was actually a sit-in. That way, it was happening at McGill University and at UCAM on the same day.
I was talking to the security people at Concordia and asking them how they feel about this, because I realized that just within the space of 5 hours, there's about 5 or 6 different arguments going on in the hallway. So my point is that the security guy was telling me that Concordia is the only university that allows this kind of political freedom within its domain. So maybe just the fact that now Concordia is feeling that it allows too much freedom for its students to vocalize their political opinions is that it's worried now about its image. And there are people who were walking around and saying that it's become an Arab university and that they don't want to be there.
Well, they shouldn't have allowed it to happen in the first place if they weren't going to...
Well, yeah, but this opens up a whole bunch of
the question is, Hala, you can't say you can have so much freedom but not too much freedom.
Yeah.
You either have freedom or you don't have freedom.
Yeah.
And as long as the exhibition was held peacefully, there was no obscenity, there was no profanity, it's an illustration, it's a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the administration is going against the freedom of expression, period.
Yes.
Beautiful.
And this has been a special presentation of Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. I want to thank all the wonderful folks that we've had in studio, including Labib Habib, and the representation that we have here from CKUT, La Croix Palestinia, which is a show that airs 11:30 to 12 o'clock on Mondays, Caravan Wednesdays 2 to 3. Tune in for that. And Hala Yahila always here on Off the Hour every day of the week. You can tune in for community news between 5 and 6 p.m. Thank you so much. If you have any comments or questions about community news here at CKUT, you can give our spoken word department a call at 398-6787, extension 2593. That's the 514 area code. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
And if you have any comments for Hala Yahela or anything else that went on today, please do email us, halayahela1@hotmail.com. That's halayahela1@hotmail.com. We do take criticism. Thank you very much.